Hello, and welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take a stack of your sources, maybe articles, research, even your own notes, and we really pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge or insight. Think of it as, a shortcut to being well-informed. We try to find surprising facts, maybe just enough humor to keep you hooked along the way.
Absolutely.
Today, we're doing a deep dive into the pages of the Washington Post for Sunday, August 10th, 2025. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst, and we're going to navigate, a really diverse landscape of topics today, Lee. It's quite the mix.
It really is.
From the shifting sands of Washington politics and, these global conflicts to the very personal impacts of economic policy and technological change, stuff that affects your daily life.
Right.
And we even have some fascinating human interest stories, too. They really highlight, I think, resilience, human quirks, that kind of thing. Our goal, as always, is to help you understand not just what is happening, but really why it matters.
Connecting the dots.
Connecting the dots, exactly, across all these varied subjects so you can kind of see the bigger picture.
That's it, exactly. We've definitely got a lot to unpack here, so let's just dive right in. Okay, segment one, Washington's shifting power dynamics. We're kicking things off with, a pretty significant shakeup right at the heart of the U.S. government. And it's one that really touches on privacy, executive authority, and, the independence of these critical agencies. The recent ouster of IRS Commissioner Billy Long. It isn't just like a personnel change. It feels like a real flashpoint in this ongoing tension between agency autonomy and, executive demands.
Absolutely.
The core event here is his forced removal. This happened on Friday, August 8th, and it came after a major clash with the White House and specifically the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, over releasing confidential taxpayer data.
Right.
This feels like more than just, some bureaucratic squabble, doesn't
Yeah, absolutely does. I mean,
it?
this situation, it raises really critical questions about the balance of power within the government. And frankly, the potential for federal agencies to be, leveraged for much broader policy agendas, like mass deportation, potentially. What happened was quite specific. DHS sent the IRS this list, 40,000 names of suspected undocumented immigrants.
40,000.
And they requested confidential taxpayer data to verify addresses, basically to locate these individuals. But what's even more striking, maybe alarming, is that DHS hinted this request could expand to 7 million people.
7 million. That's staggering.
It's an unprecedented demand for sensitive personal information. Just huge.
So the IRS, they must have pushed back.
They did. And importantly, the IRS's own privacy lawyers had previously objected to an agreement made back in April, an agreement that was supposed to facilitate this exact kind of data sharing. So they were clearly signaling concerns, about the legal and ethical boundaries way before this specific request.
The alarm bells were already ringing.
Exactly. So when the IRS responded last Friday that they could only verify fewer than 3% of the names submitted, Commissioner Long's consistent stance came into play
Which was.
that his agency would simply not furnish confidential taxpayer information outside of the agreed very narrow confines. He was basically upholding what he saw as the fundamental privacy firewall for American taxpayers.
And it seems this wasn't like an isolated incident for Commissioner Long. The article mentions other clashes too.
That's right. It sounds like he wasn't exactly in lockstep with the administration on other fronts either. Beyond this data dispute, he also sparred with Treasury officials over plans to delay the tax filing season all the way to February.
Right, I remember that.
And he had apparently prematurely announced the elimination of the IRS's direct file program, even though no final decision had actually been made on that.
So it sounds like maybe he was already on shaky ground, but this data issue, this was the final straw.
It certainly seems like the catalyst, yeah. The White House spokeswoman, Abigail Jackson, her statement framed it very carefully.
How so?
She said the administration is working in lockstep to eliminate information silos and to prevent illegal aliens from taking advantage of benefits meant for hardworking American taxpayers.
Okay, so positioning it as efficiency and fraud prevention.
Exactly. That's the surface argument. But, when you consider the consistent resistance from the IRS privacy lawyers and Commissioner Long himself, this really sets a concerning precedent for handling sensitive personal info.
It
It
does.
really blurs the lines on what constitutes an information silo versus what is actually an essential privacy firewall, one that protects your data, my data, everyone's data.
Yeah.
So the deeper insight here, I think, is that this isn't just a one-off personnel decision. It could very well be a calculated test.
At a test.
Yeah, revealing how far an administration is willing to push the boundaries of agency independence. It risks turning these, you know, traditionally nonpartisan data custodians into political instruments.
Which erodes trust.
Exactly. It erodes public trust in institutions like the IRS over the long term. A quiet but potentially profound shift.
Okay, so moving from those internal power struggles to a more global stage, we see another pretty significant redefinition of U.S. policy happening.
Hmm.
The Trump administration is, well, significantly expanding the use of tariffs. But not just for traditional trade reasons, right? It's more about using them as a tool for broad national security goals.
Yeah, particularly containing China's strategic influence.
Yeah.
This isn't just about, you know, widgets and soybeans anymore.
It's definitely not. What's really fascinating here is how creative or maybe, you know, aggressive these applications of tariffs have become.
Right.
These internal government documents, they reveal the extent of this shift. Like, get this. State Department officials actually considered demanding that U.S. trading partners vote against an international effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from container ships.
Wow. Linking climate policy to trade.
Exactly. They described it as a global carbon tax. And they were looking to tie opposition to it directly to ongoing bilateral trade negotiations.
So suddenly, environmental policy, a global climate thing, becomes a trade chip, a bargaining tool with real economic teeth.
Yeah. And it gets even more specific, targeting strategic infrastructure.
It does. The administration apparently debated requiring Israel to eliminate a Chinese company's control of the Haifa port.
That was a 25-year contract, right, from 2015.
That's the one. And they were also pressing Australia to revisit its 99-year lease with a China-backed firm for the Port of Darwin.
Which hosts U.S. Marines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So these aren't just about, you know, economic goods. They're about strategic military and infrastructure control. It shows how trade policy is being, you know, weaponized to achieve these broader geopolitical ends.
The documents also mention using tariffs for just, like, general geopolitical alignment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
For example, insisting South Korea publicly support deploying U.S. troops to deter China, not just North Korea, using trade leverage for military posture.
Mm.
And there are past examples cited too, like imposing tariffs on Colombian goods unless its leader accepted deported migrants.
Mm.
Or even threatening tariffs on Brazil if the prosecution of former President Jair Bolsonaro wasn't halted.
So connecting trade to migration policy, even domestic legal matters in other countries. Powerful stuff.
It is. These are really powerful economic levers being pulled, linking all these seemingly disparate issues.
The article mentions these moves sent shockwaves through the government because, well, it's not normally how it works.
Uh-huh.
Yet the White House has celebrated this approach. They're highlighting the significant tariff revenue. They're collecting, what was it, $29 billion in July?
Yeah, and expecting it to reach $50 billion a month. They frame it as beneficial for the American people.
Right. But, okay, if tariffs are essentially taxes on imports paid often by U.S. companies and consumers, what are the tangible economic consequences for everyday Americans?
Well, this is where we see that significant disconnect. It's often called the Wall Street-Main Street tariff disconnect.
Okay.
An opinion piece highlighted this. Americans now face an average import tax rate of 18.6%. That is the highest it's been since 1933.
Wow, since the Depression era.
Yeah. And companies, big ones like Caterpillar, you know, a real bellwether for the industrial economy.
Right.
They anticipate significant hits to their bottom line. They're projecting $1.3 billion to $1.5 billion this year just due to these tariffs.
Ouch. But the stock market seems okay.
Well, yeah, the stock market might appear resilient, but that's largely buoyed by the AI boom and its perceived benefits, right?
True.
But these tariffs, they disproportionately hurt lower income Americans. They're squeezing budgets for essentials. Groceries, for instance.
Yeah, the article mentioned a poll.
Right. 53% of Americans cite groceries as a major source of stress.
Mm.
These tariffs add to that pressure. So the deeper insight here, I think, is that this is more than just economic divergence. It's a deliberate narrative conflict.
How so?
The administration highlights the revenue, suggesting this shared benefit, right? But the data points to a kind of silent tax, mainly falling on the less affluent. You see this growing chasm between the rhetorical benefits of the policy and its tangible, often painful, ground-level impact, especially when it's hidden behind these broad national security claims.
That's a really powerful point about the uneven impact. It's not just abstract numbers. It's real families feeling that pinch.
Exactly.
It also makes you wonder about the administration's confidence in the economy overall, given, you know, the recent firing of the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics over a bad jobs report and the rise in unemployment benefit claims.
Right, and former House Speaker Paul Ryan warning of choppy waters ahead. It all paints a picture of underlying economic tension despite some surface indicators.
Okay, so from those broad strokes of economic policy, we pivot now to an individual, someone who, despite lacking any official White House role, no press credentials, seems to wield surprising influence.
Uh-huh.
Laura Loomer, a far-right activist and journalist. The article describes her unlikely access and powerful perch in Donald Trump's orbit. It calls this a core phenomenon in today's Washington.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating here is her modus operandi, her method.
Right. How does she operate?
Loomer apparently uncovers information she thinks will interest Trump. She shares it with his officials. And then, crucially, she simultaneously publicizes it.
Where?
On her website, on X, or her streaming show, Loomer Unleashed. She seems to operate with his confidence that her information will reach the president.
Why?
Largely due to her established reputation within that circle as a trusted ally. Trump himself has publicly praised her, called her a very nice person and a patriot.
Mm.
He said he likes her enthusiasm for exposing perceived harms to the country.
Oh.
So this really illustrates a significant shift in who holds influence.
You know? It bypasses traditional structure.
Exactly. An activist with a strong social media presence and perceived loyalty can directly impact personnel decisions, public discourse, bypassing traditional media, bypassing established political structures.
And this influence isn't just theoretical, right? We saw a very public example recently with the FDA.
Absolutely. That was striking. The administration initially directed the ouster, this was July 29th, of Vinay Prasad.
The FDA's top vaccine and gene therapy regulator.
Right. And this happened after he was targeted by a right-wing pressure campaign that specifically included Loomer.
Why was he targeted?
Over his drug approval approach and, significantly, his past support for Democrats. So it looked like a direct result of her influence campaign.
What's really interesting, though, is the pushback that followed and the reversal.
That's a crucial detail, yes. After the White House apparently reevaluated the criticisms, finding them disingenuous.
Ooh, intervene.
FDA Commissioner Marty Makary intervened. And following that intervention, Prasad was actually reinstated.
So her influence isn't absolute.
It suggests it isn't, or at least that her actions can prompt a contested outcome. The administration can reverse course when faced with further scrutiny or, you know, internal pressure from established figures like the FDA commissioner.
Okay. But her reach extends into areas you really wouldn't expect to be politicized. This is where it gets kind of wild, like military valor.
Yeah, this was quite something. Loomer sharply criticized Army Secretary Dan Driscoll.
Why?
For recognizing Medal of Honor recipient Florent Groberg on social media. She actually suggested Groberg was undeserving.
Undeserving. A Medal of Honor recipient. On what grounds?
Because he spoke at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. And because he was not U.S. born.
He was born in France, right?
Yeah.
Became a citizen later. Served. Saved lives.
Precisely. Loomer defended her criticism, saying it was necessary to prevent the Army from pushing out Democratic propaganda. She cited other examples like the Army highlighting Representative Eugene Vindman or Jennifer Easterly, who she sees as Trump opponents.
Wow. So attacking a Medal of Honor recipient for perceived political affiliation?
This particular incident, it raises a really important question about the politicization of institutions we normally see as nonpartisan.
Especially the military.
Yeah. How did the Army respond? An Army official strongly defended Groberg, called him a national hero, and Loomer's attack despicable. Stated unequivocally that the Army, quote, is not going to check the political affiliation of our soldiers before we recognize them.
As it should be.
Right. Groberg himself expressed amazement. He emphasized his alive day, the day he was nearly killed, saving lives, and his oath to the country, not to politics.
Mm.
So the very public nature of Loomer's attacks, her ability to generate this internal debate, it underscores a new kind of unpredictable dimension of power. Where even military valor gets subjected to partisan scrutiny. It challenges that long-held norm of military impartiality.
And just for context on Loomer, her background includes working for Project Veritas, getting banned from Uber and Lyft for an anti-Islamic immigrant rant, getting kicked off Twitter for calling a Democratic representative anti-Semitic.
Right. And her Twitter, or X, follower count apparently surged to 1.3 million after Elon Musk reinstated her.
It's just a striking example of how social media platforms have amplified voices that once operated maybe on the fringes, now giving them what seems like a direct line to power.
Okay, so as we're looking at these shifts in influence, it's probably worth noting other developments shaping the political landscape, future elections too. We're seeing different facets of the political machine at play here, aren't we? From, you know, the ambitious groundwork for future elections to shifting criteria for high-level appointments, even the strategic calculations behind career decisions on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, it all paints this picture of how politicians are adapting or trying to adapt to an extremely polarized and frankly uncertain political climate.
So what's catching attention early on?
What's fascinating is the early presidential buzz around a first-term Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego of Arizona.
Already? For 2028?
Yeah, he's already making campaign swings into Iowa. You know, the traditional presidential primary state.
That's his message. It emphasizes hope and the need for Democrats to re-engage with working-class Americans, including those who voted for Donald Trump.
Interesting strategy.
He points to Arizona's transformation from solid red to having two Democratic U.S. senators, a Democratic governor, AG, Secretary of State, as a potential model for Iowa. It suggests this pragmatic strategy for rebuilding party strength. He's urging Democrats to have those, quote, uncomfortable conversations with voters who might feel alienated.
It's definitely a proactive move for a first-termer.
Very much so. It signals a belief that the traditional path, starting early in key states, is maybe still viable, even now.
Okay, and then on the appointments front, we've got President Trump's nomination of Tammy Bruce.
Right, the State Department spokeswoman.
Nominated as Deputy Representative to the United Nations, a position with ambassadorial status.
And the article really highlights that Bruce has, quote, no prior experience in U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah.
None mentioned. And it notes her, shall we say, unorthodox conduct at State Department briefings.
Like what?
Including unilaterally rearranging the seating charts for journalists. And sometimes apparently being unaware of key decisions, like Secretary of State Marco Rubio being named interim White House National Security Advisor.
So what does this appointment signal?
Well, it seems to signify a continued emphasis on loyalty over traditional qualifications within this administration.
Right.
It speaks to this broader trend where, you know, maybe deep experience in diplomacy or foreign policy is less valued than perceived ideological alignment and maybe a willingness to challenge established norms.
Yeah, selecting someone with zero foreign policy background for an ambassadorial role at the UN, it's a stark example.
It reinforces that focus on a specific kind of fidelity, perhaps over expertise.
And then there's this other interesting dynamic, the unusually slow congressional retirement season.
Yeah, that caught my eye too. It's particularly slow among House incumbents in swing districts. Only 8 Democrats and 11 Republicans are retiring from the House. Another 15 are running for higher office, but that's still low for retirements.
And this contrasts sharply with previous cycles, right?
Hugely. Think back to 2017, there was a flood of Republican retirements. 52 House members quit, the largest wave in 30 years. That was right before the Democrats took over the House in 2018.
Right.
And similarly, in 2009, there was a wave of Democratic retirements in red states before the big GOP gains in 2010.
So why are they staying put now? Instead of jumping ship, they're holding tight.
It seems lawmakers are waiting. Waiting for the political environment to maybe clear up. And crucially, waiting for potential redistricting changes to settle.
Ah, redistricting.
New district lines could just make their seats politically untenable, unwinnable. So why leave now if the map might change dramatically?
Makes sense.
And political analysts suggest that in today's hyper-divided country, the candidate's identity in House races often matters less than just the party affiliation.
The R or D next to the name.
Exactly. Swing voters often just side with the party out of power. So that might make some incumbents hesitant to retire. They're holding out, maybe hoping for a favorable redistricting or a shift in the national mood.
So it indicates they're keenly aware of how these big currents could just drastically alter their reelection chances.
Precisely.
Huh?
It makes the battle for control of the House even more intense, more uncertain. It's a strategic calculus driven by that extreme polarization we keep talking about.
Okay, segment 2, governance, law, and public discourse. We're turning now to a, well, a pretty dramatic standoff playing out in Texas. The political fight over redistricting there has escalated into an outright legislative showdown. It's basically a fight fire with fire strategy from the Democrats.
It really is.
Texas Republican lawmakers, reportedly at President Trump's urging, initiated this unusual mid-decade effort to redraw congressional maps, their aim, to gain 5 additional GOP seats.
5 seats, that's significant.
Yeah. And in response, Democratic state lawmakers staged this high-profile walkout. They actually fled the state to prevent a quorum, to halt the legislative process.
A bold move. Reminds you of past political maneuvers, but this time feels a bit different.
How so?
Well, what's particularly notable about this Democratic exodus is the level of coordination and solidarity involved.
It wasn't spontaneous.
Doesn't sound like it. It was apparently coordinated with top national Democrats. People like California Governor Gavin Newsom, House Minority Leader Akeem Jeffries, even former Attorney General Eric Holder.
Wow, big names involved.
And crucially, DNC Chair Ken Martin was also involved this time, actively providing solidarity.
Why is that significant?
Because a previous walkout back in 2021 reportedly felt unsupported by national party figures.
Yeah.
This time, it suggests a much more unified, maybe more aggressive stance from Democrats nationally on the issue of gerrymandering.
Right. Signaling a willingness to back extreme measures at the state level.
To block what they see as anti-democratic moves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Feels like a nationalized fight playing out in Texas.
And the Republican response has been equally aggressive, right?
Oh, absolutely. Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Attorney General Ken Paxton declared the lawmakers derelict officials who abandoned their duties. They vowed to use every tool at their disposal to bring them back.
What kind of tools?
Civil arrest warrants were issued by the House Speaker. Lawsuits were filed in both Texas and Illinois, where some of the Democrats fled. Governor Abbott even floated these unsubstantiated allegations of bribery against the absent lawmakers, claiming they were soliciting funds to evade fines. The rhetoric is incredibly heated.
So this raises fundamental questions, doesn't it, about legislative process, legal boundaries?
It really does. And legal experts seem pretty clear on one point. The FBI has no legitimate role in this partisan battle.
Why not?
Well, for the FBI to intervene, the lawmakers would need to be accused of a federal crime or fleeing to avoid prosecution on state criminal charges. Neither has happened here.
These are civil warrants.
Exactly. Civil warrants aren't tied to criminal charges, and state authorities can't enforce them out of state. Now, Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, he suggested federal prosecution under some statute.
Statute?
Something about making it illegal to cross state lines to avoid legal process of civil warrants. But experts think that would face significant judicial pushback. It seems like a stretch.
Has this happened before, Democrats fleeing Texas?
Yes, back in 2003, amidst another redistricting battle. And the FBI reportedly provided only minimal aid, then basically one phone call to locate them.
So despite the strong rhetoric from the GOP, their legal options to force an immediate return seem limited.
Quite limited, yeah. Which puts the real onus on political pressure and, crucially, public opinion.
So the real battle isn't just in the legislature, it's in the court of public opinion.
Precisely. And the article includes an interesting opinion piece on this titled, What Greg Abbott and the Texas GOP Can Learn from Wisconsin in 2011.
Ah, drawing parallels to a similar walkout in Wisconsin.
Right. And this piece argues that a winning message against absent lawmakers is to really emphasize that, you know, a person who consistently fails to report to work gets fired.
Frame it as dereliction of duty.
Exactly. And to clearly communicate the why behind the proposed reforms to shape that public narrative. It's about framing the issue in terms of duty, accountability. Less about the underlying political motives for the redistricting itself.
So it's not just a fight over legislative power. It's a sophisticated battle over public perception. Which narrative sticks?
That's it, exactly. A battle for the narrative.
Okay, so from the mechanics of political power, let's transition to how technology, often designed for convenience, can have these profound, often unintended consequences. Consequences for our democratic processes, for the flow of information. And the perfect example here seems to be Apple's new mobile operating system, iOS 26.
Right, scheduled for release next month.
It includes this feature to curb spam calls and texts. It segregates messages from unknown senders, people not in your contacts, into a separate screen, one you might not check often.
And for unknown callers, the phone will automatically ask for more info before even asking if you want to connect.
Sounds helpful for spam, but
it's a classic case of unintended consequences, and the potential fallout is really significant.
House, so.
While it's definitely helpful for fighting spam, it's expected to have an immediate and disruptive effect on high-quality polling.
Disruptive to polling, like political polls?
Political polls, yes, but also legitimate survey research, like public health surveys from government agencies. Critical stuff.
Why would it disrupt polling?
Well, good polling, reliable polling, relies on probability sampling. Mm. Make sure everyone has an equal chance of being included.
Right.
Historically, they used landlines. Now, increasingly, it's mobile phones and text messages. Those are ubiquitous technologies.
Okay.
Now, internet surveys exist, sure, but most are opt-in. They often lack the comprehensive coverage you need, especially at the state and local level, to get a truly representative sample.
So, by trying to filter out spam, Apple might accidentally filter out, well, accurate public opinion. It limits the very civic discourse it relies on.
That's a really powerful way to put it. The article warns that local polling could all but disappear.
Disappear.
Yeah, making it basically impossible to get enough people to tap over to their unknown sender screen to even participate in surveys.
Wow. And the ripple effects of that?
Well, it makes it much harder to measure local opinion accurately, harder to hold local elected officials accountable. It could further erode local news and investigative journalism, which often rely on these polls to gauge community sentiment.
So it raises this crucial question. Who gets to be the traffic cop for civic speech?
Exactly. How can private companies, just through their design choices, inadvertently become gatekeepers of information that's essential to the health of our democracy?
Yeah.
The struggle for accurate public opinion data in this age of just information overload, it becomes even more acute when a private company's design choice has such far-reaching civic implications.
That's a truly concerning ripple effect. Are there any proposed solutions mentioned, ways around this?
The article does suggest several alternatives. One is using third-party verification platforms.
Like what?
Things like 10DLC and Campaign Verify. They're designed to distinguish legitimate senders, like pollsters, from bad actors, sort of like a trusted sender badge.
Oh, okay.
It also proposes enshrining protections for bona fide research into policy, making sure legitimate surveys aren't caught in this dragnet designed for spammers.
Makes sense.
And finally, it suggests leveraging AI, not just to filter out fraud, but maybe to intelligently allow legitimate polling through.
Interesting. Using AI for discernment, not just blocking.
Right. And this connects to a broader point raised in a book review mentioned in the Post. Mm. The review is titled, "This Book is Impossible to Argue With." And that's not a good thing.
Intriguing title.
It critiques the idea that expressing any ideology or context automatically shuts down debate. The book's author, Thomas Chatterton Williams, argues for focusing only on facts in the here and now. But the review counters that this approach can actually curtail the very free expression of ideas it claims to defend. It can be too narrow.
And the connection to the Apple update.
Well, if we can't even get the basic facts of public opinion because of technological filtering, then the ability to have an informed debate, let alone one that engages with ideology or context, is severely compromised, isn't it?
Yeah. If you can't establish the baseline reality, how can you debate solutions or interpretations?
Very concerning. Okay, segment 3, societal challenges and economic realities.
Yeah.
From the halls of power and the intricacies of technology, let's zoom in now on the very tangible impacts of national economic policies on everyday life. Starting with urban austerity, Syracuse, New York is apparently experiencing a sharp $16 million drop in spending. That's forcing significant budget cuts, cuts that ripple through public services.
Right. And the article stresses this isn't just Syracuse. It mirrors budget woes playing out around the country. Cities like Los Angeles, Houston, Sioux Falls, Yakima, they're all facing similar pressures. So what's driving these shortfalls? It paints a stark picture.
It really does. It shows how national economic policies and these broader market conditions translate directly into visible cuts in local services, things that affect your everyday quality of life.
Yeah.
And the root causes, according to the article, are attributed directly to Trump's tariff policies and slowing housing markets.
Ah, the tariffs again, and housing. How do they impact city budgets specifically?
Well, think about it. Tariffs on imported goods, while maybe intended to help domestic industries, can raise costs for consumers and businesses locally. That impacts local economic activity, sales tax revenue, things like that.
Okay.
And a slowdown in housing markets. That means less property tax revenue for cities. And property tax is often a huge chunk of their budget.
So we're talking real immediate impacts for residents then. Fewer services, lower quality of life.
Absolutely. Very tangible changes. Residents in Syracuse, for example, can expect fewer trash pickups, more potholes. Specific cuts include big reductions in road salt for winter, a 44% cut to litter cleanup crews, a 20% cut to pothole filling.
Basic services.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The police department faces a $3.5 million cut that affects things like ShotSpotter cameras, though some patrols were apparently restored after some unruly groups emerged.
Mm-hmm.
The fire department. A $2.4 million cut that impacts things like free smoke and carbon monoxide detector installations, vital public safety services, especially for lower-income residents.
Wow.
Even two housing inspectors were eliminated. The mayor warned that negatively impacts the ability of the city to help ensure safe, quality housing.
These aren't abstract numbers at all. These are fundamental services.
Yeah.
Health, safety, daily life.
Directly impacted, yeah.
It sounds like a difficult political battle played out locally in Syracuse over these cuts, too.
It did. Mayor Walsh, who's an independent, he opposed the cuts.
Yeah.
He advocated for a small 2% property tax increase instead.
Okay.
And he wanted to use $27 million from the city's rainy day fund.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, their emergency savings.
His argument.
He argued passionately for robust services, especially for the one-third of residents living in poverty. He basically said, look, it is raining, based on the uncertainty from Washington, so we should use the fund now.
Makes sense. But the council disagreed.
The city council, yeah. They apparently feared a bigger financial crisis could be looming if they drained the reserves. They prioritized fiscal caution, maybe long-term stability, over immediate service levels. They actually overrode Walsh's veto.
Tough choices.
Really difficult choices local governments face when these national economic pressures collide with community needs and, you know, very limited resources.
This local struggle in Syracuse, it really connects to the larger national economic worries we touched on earlier, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Feels like Syracuse is kind of a microcosm of a much bigger fiscal challenge.
It reflects this pervasive economic uncertainty that stretches from city halls all the way to the national capital. There's an opinion piece mentioned, Five Ways to Stop the Onrushing Debt Disaster.
By who?
Harvard economics professor N. Gregory Mankiw. And it offers a pretty dire outlook on the national fiscal trajectory.
Dire how?
He outlines five ways to halt rising debt, but calls them all long shot ways.
What are they?
Okay, one, extraordinary economic growth.
Mm.
Two, government default, basically not paying its debts. Three, large scale money creation, essentially printing money. Four, substantial spending cuts. Or five, large tax increases.
None of those sound easy or likely.
Exactly. He suggests there's this odd optimism in Washington that Congress will act before Social Security's trust fund runs out, supposedly by 2033.
Which would mean huge benefit cuts if they don't act.
Over 20% benefit cuts, yeah.
Yeah.
But Mankiw argues this optimism is basically delusional.
Ouch. Why?
He warns that Congress might just amend the law to fill the shortfalls with general revenue, which sounds okay, but it just means more borrowing.
Kicking the can down the road?
Right. And potentially sparking higher interest rates in the bond market as debt piles up.
Mm.
So this directly links the struggles of cities like Syracuse facing these immediate painful cuts to essential services to that broader looming national debt crisis.
Suggesting the austerity we see locally might just be the leading edge.
The leading edge of a much larger fiscal reckoning potentially coming down the line. Yeah.
Okay, from cities bracing for austerity, let's shift focus to the pressures facing higher education. It really seems to be at a crossroads, doesn't it? Multiple challenges impacting access, affordability, equity.
Yeah, it's not just about tuition anymore. It's about fundamental questions, really, about how these institutions operate.
So what's one major pressure point?
Well, one significant issue is this federal class action lawsuit. It accuses 32 elite universities. Names like Wesleyan, Washington University in St. Louis, Vassar, are mentioned of violating antitrust laws.
Antitrust? How?
The accusation is that they're using binding early decision admissions to, quote, inflate prices and reduce competition.
Binding early decision.
Yeah.
That's where students commit early, right?
Exactly. They commit to attend before they know their full financial aid package. They're locked in.
Which means they can't compare offers for other schools that might give them more aid.
Precisely. This legal challenge, it follows a similar lawsuit back in 2022 against 16 other elite universities over how they calculated financial aid. So it suggests this growing legal scrutiny of these long-standing practices.
So the core insight here is
that these lawsuits are trying to dismantle a system that critics say really prioritizes the institution's enrollment numbers and financial stability over genuine student financial equity and access. Are they putting their bottom line first?
Right. Is it about transparency for students and their ability to choose the most affordable path? That seems to be the question.
That's the heart of it. And adding another significant layer of pressure on colleges.
Yeah.
President Trump has ordered the Education Department to collect extensive admissions data from colleges.
What kind of data?
Including grades, test scores, broken down by race.
Ah, why? What's the stated goal?
The administration's stated goal is to ensure no racial preferences in admissions. This follows the 2023 Supreme Court ruling against race-conscious admissions.
Okay.
The White House argues that schools are using essays about how race impacted an applicant's life as a kind of loophole to continue considering race, thereby getting around the spirit of the Supreme Court's ruling.
So this data collection.
While it's framed as enforcing the court's ruling, it's seen by some critics as part of a broader push. A push to reshape cultural norms and policies in higher ed, potentially limiting how institutions can foster diversity, even through means the court seemed to allow, like considering race in personal essays.
Okay. And what about the elephant in the room, student loan debt? That continues to be a massive burden.
Yeah, the article College Cost Again comes into focus, highlights this. A New York Federal Reserve report shows a concerning uptick in the rate at which balances went from current to delinquent for student loans.
Why the uptick now?
It's largely because collections resumed after those pandemic-era pauses ended. People had to start paying again.
Right.
And while, yes, a college degree can be a sound investment, graduates earn significantly more, median salary around 80K versus 47K for high school grads, a decent return on investment.
Right.
But the accumulated debt can absolutely derail other goals, as the article notes, saving for a house, starting a family, retirement.
Yeah.
And this is particularly poignant, maybe tragic, for the 2.8 million borrowers age 62 or older who are still carrying student loan debt.
Still paying in their 60s and older. Wow, how much?
A staggering $121.5 billion in student loan debt among that age group.
Unbelievable.
So that popular idea of student loans being good debt, experts quoted give that a strong eye roll. They emphasize that while it works out for many, for a substantial subset, it leads to delinquency, default, and really bad outcomes, especially later in life.
So collectively, all these dynamics, the lawsuits, the data demands, the debt burden, it really paints a picture of higher ed at a crossroads.
Absolutely. Grappling with fundamental issues. Access, affordability, equity, and maybe even the very definition of what constitutes a worthwhile investment in today's economic climate.
Okay, segment four, global tensions and environmental concerns. The global landscape, as reported in the Post, looks, well, pretty fraught with tension, revealing not just the immediate conflicts, but also these complex diplomatic efforts and, frankly, devastating humanitarian consequences. Let's start with the latest on the war in Ukraine, some surprising developments involving international leaders there.
Yeah, what's truly fascinating, maybe deeply concerning, depending on your perspective, is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's firm rejection.
Rejection of what?
Of any proposal involving ceding territory to Russia, any land swaps.
And this came right after.
Right after U.S. President Donald Trump suggested exactly that, some swapping of territories as a potential way to end the war. This happened as Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin were finalizing details for an in-person meeting in Alaska, of all places.
Alaska? Symbolism there, maybe? Former Russian territory?
Perhaps. But Zelensky was unequivocal. He stressed Ukraine's constitution prohibits territorial retreat. He said, quote, "Ukrainians will not give their land to the occupier. Full stop."
That sets up a massive diplomatic challenge, doesn't it? One key party rejecting a central premise of a potential peace deal before talks even begin.
A profound challenge, yes. Especially given the U.S. president's comments. It really puts a spotlight on the divisions within the international community about how to achieve peace here.
How are other allies reacting? Europe, for instance.
Well, European and Ukrainian officials quickly pushed back. They called for robust and credible security guarantees and a ceasefire before any negotiations start.
And on the territory issue.
They asserted that international borders must not be changed by force. They argue the current line of contact should be the starting point, not some post-invasion concession to Russia.
And the territorial complexity is just immense, right?
It's huge.
Yeah.
You've got Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea back in 2014, their seizure of significant parts of eastern and southern Ukraine, ongoing pushes now into the Sumy region. It's incredibly messy.
Trump's rhetoric on Ukraine has been a bit inconsistent, hasn't it?
Very inconsistent. He previously blamed Kyiv for the invasion, but recently seemed to soften his stance while getting tougher on Russia, but then agreeing to host Putin after his envoy visited Moscow. That stirs fears.
Fears that he might.
That he could be leaning toward a deal that compromises Ukraine, legitimizes Russia's gains, and maybe ultimately just prolongs the conflict by rewarding aggression.
So this whole situation reveals deep rifts among allies and the immense complexity of negotiating peace when one side's ambitions clash so fundamentally with international law and sovereignty.
Exactly. A high-stakes diplomatic tightrope, as you said.
Okay, now shifting focus to Gaza. The humanitarian situation there sounds absolutely dire. Warnings of widespread famine.
It is devastatingly so. Experts are warning that a wave of starvation is sweeping across Gaza, and the medical challenges are just immense.
How so?
Treating severe acute malnutrition, or SAM, it's incredibly complex. You need specific things like ready-to-use therapeutic food, RUTF, specialized therapeutic milks, and really careful medical observation.
Why the careful observation?
To prevent severe complications like refeeding syndrome. That's a really dangerous metabolic shift that can happen when severely malnourished people are fed too quickly. It can cause heart failure, even death.
Wow. And the resources in Gaza.
Gaza's four specialized malnutrition centers are completely overstretched and running low on fuel. Vital supplies like that therapeutic milk are expected to run out by mid-August. Very soon.
And even if they get treatment.
Relapse rates are high. Because of the chronic food insecurity, the lack of nutritious food generally, and critically, access to clean water is also essential for survival. But it remains scarce. It's a multifaceted crisis.
And on the political side, there seems to be this significant disconnect in how world leaders are even talking about this crisis.
Yeah, quite a disconnect. While Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dismissed reports of famine as a bold-faced lie, President Donald Trump has acknowledged real starvation is happening.
So conflicting narratives from key players.
It highlights this struggle for narrative control right in the middle of immense human suffering. And that makes coordinated international action even more challenging.
And aid delivery itself is complicated.
Hugely complicated. Israel has imposed a near-total blockade on Gaza. And against that backdrop, this U.S. and Israeli-backed entity, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF.
A new organization.
Newly formed, yeah. It controversially replaced the traditional U.N. aid distribution back in late May.
And how's that going?
Not well. According to the U.N. and other established aid groups, they've sharply criticized the GHF, not just for operational shortcomings, but for the truly tragic fact that over 1,300 people have reportedly been killed while just seeking aid at GHF sites.
Killed while seeking aid? By whom?
Mostly by the Israeli military, according to those reports. It's a critical point, because the Famine Review Committee stated that the GHF's distribution plan would lead to mass starvation, even if it functioned without violence.
That's horrifying.
The whole Gaza crisis is just a stark reminder of how conflict spirals into widespread humanitarian disaster, exacerbated by political disagreements, immense logistical challenges in aid distribution, revealing the tragic human cost when political narratives clash so violently with on-the-ground realities.
Okay, from the complexities of geopolitics and these humanitarian crises, let's explore our relationship with the environment. It seems fraught with both, you know, innovative solutions and stark realities, often complicated by data issues, too.
Yeah, and the discussion around these tiny nuclear reactors is a prime example, a technological solution that brings its own whole set of risks and societal debates.
Tiny nuclear reactors, what are we talking about?
About half a dozen companies are developing these microreactors. They're miniaturized nuclear power units, apparently small enough to fit on a flatbed truck.
Wow, how much power?
About 1 megawatt.
Yeah.
Enough for maybe 1,000 homes or a factory.
And they're different from traditional reactors.
Supposedly, quite different. They don't require water for coolant. They use helium gas or molten salt instead. And they rely on this unique fuel called TRISO.
TRISO? What's that?
It stands for tristructural isotropic particle fuel. Basically, tiny fuel particles coated with multiple layers of ceramic materials. They're designed to contain the radioactive stuff even at extremely high temperatures, theoretically making them meltdown-proof.
Meltdown-proof? That's a big claim.
It is. And backers see them as this clean, maybe cheaper alternative for remote inner needs. Think mines, factories, remote islands.
Okay.
Even potentially for space exploration, like powering lunar bases. The Energy Department is apparently pushing for expedited tests and approval.
Why the push?
Driven partly by the explosive needs of AI developers. They hope to deploy these as early as 2028.
That sounds incredibly promising, like a real quantum leap for clean energy, especially with AI's massive energy demands. But there's always a but, isn't there?
There usually is. And it's a significant one here. Scientists quoted warn that these claims of meltdown-proof safety are vastly overblown.
Why?
They argue a radiological release could still be triggered by an explosion, a technical malfunction, even a deliberate attack. And crucially, the U.S. still lacks a permanent centralized disposal solution for highly radioactive nuclear waste from any reactor, big or small.
So the waste from these microreactors
could just linger at the project sites.
Yeah.
Potentially for decades, raising huge local environmental and safety concerns.
Are communities resisting?
Some are already. Like in Barnum, Wyoming, they're opposing a radiant manufacturing and storage site for these reactors.
Right.
Furthermore, that TRISO fuel's ability to truly withstand extreme heat during a malfunction, well, it hasn't been fully proven under all potential real-world conditions.
So promising for energy, but big question marks remain on safety and waste. Echoes of traditional nuclear debates.
Very much so.
And speaking of data, there's a fascinating and frankly pretty concerning story about climate data errors. Highlights the fragility of these scientific models we rely on.
Yeah, this story really underscores the absolute necessity of rigorous data testing, verification in these critical scientific studies, studies that influence global policy.
What happened?
A big error in a global climate study's results was attributed solely to Uzbekistan's erroneous data. Just one country's bad data.
And the impact.
It dramatically changed the study's predictions for global GDP loss from climate damage, changed it from a staggering 62% loss down to 23% loss by the year 2100.
Wow. One country's data had that much influence.
It seems counterintuitive, right? Given the sheer volume of global data points. But it highlights how sensitive these models can be to input errors.
So the takeaways.
The need for meticulous, independent verification of data inputs. Because even a seemingly minor error can drastically alter how dire the climate projections look, and consequently, how urgently policymakers respond.
And closer to home, right here in the DC area, we're apparently facing intensified flood risks. A very tangible illustration of climate impact.
Yes, a new analysis and flood mapping effort by the National Capital Region Transportation Planning Board. It shows large swaths of the Washington region are more vulnerable to flooding than was previously known.
More vulnerable than we thought. How much?
By 2050, an additional 3% of the DC region's roadways are projected to be at risk of flooding.
And this includes areas previously considered low risk.
Exactly. Areas deemed low risk by the official FEMA maps. But these areas have already experienced serious flash floods, significant damage.
Like that terrible incident on Rhode Island Avenue.
The August 2023 flash flood. Yeah. Tragically killed 10 dogs at a canine daycare. That area wasn't considered high risk.
Why the increased risk?
Well, DC's average temperature has risen 6 degrees in 150 years. That increased warmth means the air holds more moisture.
Leading to more intense storms.
More intense, sudden downpours that just overwhelm the existing drainage infrastructure.
And this leads right into concerns about a more active hurricane season, compounding these extreme weather worries.
It does. The Atlantic hurricane season is indeed becoming more active as we approach its typical peak. We've already had four named storms, Andrea, Barry, Chantal, Dexter.
And they've caused problems.
Two of them brought deadly downpours. And forecasters are particularly concerned about East Coast landfalls this year.
Why?
Because of a marine heat wave in the Western Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. Warmer water fuels, storm intensity, adds more moisture. That, coupled with some unfavorable air pressure patterns, raises the risk.
And amidst these real threats, there's also an issue with misinformation online.
Yeah, the article specifically warns against those viral posts you see based on long-range weather models, forecasts, looking more than 10 days out.
Those aren't reliable.
They have little scientific value that far out, according to meteorologists. They just contribute to hurricane hype, creating unnecessary anxiety, maybe confusion.
Are the newer AI forecast models any better?
They exist, and they're improving, but they still have blind spots, especially when it comes to predicting storm intensity, which is often the most critical factor.
So these flood risk reports, the hurricane season outlook, they serve as tangible, immediate warnings.
For individuals, for local governments, warnings about the urgent need to adapt to this changing climate. Even as we struggle to navigate reliable information in this, you know, noisy online world.
Okay, segment 5, human experience, culture, and everyday life. Let's explore the human side of the news now, delving into often hidden corners of public service, justice, revealing the complex human dimensions within big institutions, from national security to healthcare.
These stories often bring up really profound ethical questions and highlight the personal dedication that shapes our society, often behind the scenes.
Like the story of Sandra Grimes.
Yeah, her obituary details her central and incredibly understated role in exposing Aldrich Ames.
Considered the most damaging double agent in CIA history.
Right. Back in 1992, Grimes, she was a counterintelligence analyst. She discovered Ames's betrayal. How? By meticulously, painstakingly studying his bank deposits.
Why was that important?
Because for years, American assets, spies working for the U.S., had been disappearing in the Soviet Union, being executed. At least 8 informants were killed because of Ames.
And she found the link through his finances.
Exactly. Her quiet dedication, sifting through mountains of financial data. It's a powerful testament to that unglamorous but critical intelligence work, safeguarding national security through sheer persistence.
She wrote a book about it, too.
Co-authored Circle of Treason, yeah. It was even adapted into an ABC miniseries, The Assets, bringing her unsung heroism to a wider audience.
And then a really stark contrast to that story of quiet dedication is this legal battle surrounding the execution of Byron Black.
Yeah, a 69-year-old death row inmate.
His case touches on really profound ethical questions, right? At the intersection of medicine and capital punishment.
It ignited what the article calls a first-of-its-kind legal battle. The core issue was whether his implanted cardiac device, an ICD, an implantable cardioverter defibrillator.
The device that shocks the heart back into rhythm.
Right. Should that device be deactivated before his lethal injection to prevent it from shocking him during the execution process?
Wow. That's a grim question.
Incredibly grim. His lawyers also argued against his execution on other grounds. Intellectual disability, and that he was sentenced under pre-2002 standards.
Before the Supreme Court banned executing intellectually disabled individuals.
Exactly. And Black reportedly showed signs of distress during the execution itself, raising further questions about the humanity of the process.
So this case isn't just about one execution.
No, it raises these fundamental ethical dilemmas. Medicine, law, capital punishment. Humane execution, evolving legal standards regarding intellectual disability. It really pushes the boundaries of what might be considered cruel and unusual punishment today.
And then there's this recent incident at a major medical institution, one that raised immediate concerns about healthcare access, potentially turning a place of healing into one of fear for some communities.
Yeah, this happened at the National Institutes of Health, the NIH Clinical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. Federal immigration authorities detained a woman there.
While she was seeking medical care?
Exactly. She was an existing patient, apparently there for care. NIH officials called ICE Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Why?
Because her state driver's license failed new federal security ID standards. And a warrant check revealed she had a removal order, an order for deportation.
So NIH called ICE on their own patient.
That's what the report indicates. A Department of Health and Human Services spokesman confirmed the detainment, stating NIH clinical trials are for people here legally.
In the reaction.
It sparked immediate concerns about a chilling effect on healthcare access for immigrant communities. The National Immigration Law Center weighed in on this.
The fear being?
That when a hospital, a place of healing, becomes a place where you might be detained and deported, it transforms it into a place of fear. It could deter individuals, regardless of their status, from seeking necessary medical care.
Which impacts public health more broadly.
Absolutely. Yeah. If people are afraid to get care, diseases can spread, conditions worsen. It has wider public health implications.
Okay, from those profound, often somber aspects of human experience, let's shift gears a bit. To the lighter side of life, leisure, lifestyle, media. But even in these seemingly, you know, maybe trivial topics, we can uncover fascinating insights into human behavior and societal dynamics.
It's true. It's amazing the extremes people will go to for leisure sometimes.
Like camping out for golf.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Ahead of the Ryder Cup, the Public Bethpage Black Course in New York, a very famous, very difficult course, now requires golfers to literally camp out for tee times.
How long are they waiting?
Some waited an astonishing 44 hours.
In the parking lot?
44 hours for a tee time. Yeah. Apparently created this fast-forming community in the parking lot. People have TVs, music, poker games going. Golfers coming from all over North America.
Wow.
It highlights this extreme dedication for what's considered a bucket list item in golf. The lore of playing this acclaimed public course, I mean 44 hours, that's dedication. or maybe just a touch of madness.
Shows how aspiration can drive seemingly irrational behavior.
Absolutely.
And for those who dreamed of the stars instead of the Lynx, it seems you're never too old to chase those childhood fantasies either.
That's right. The U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama, they offer this three-day, $899 adult space camp experience.
Adult space camp? What do you do?
All the cool stuff. Multi-axis trainers that spin you around, assembling oversized Tinker toys while wearing spacesuits, building and launching model rockets, even Mars mission simulations.
Sounds fun.
It perfectly reflects this deep nostalgia, especially maybe for 80s kids, fulfilling those childhood dreams, finding a place to just totally geek out.
A testament to the enduring appeal of space, reconnecting with that childlike wonder.
Exactly.
Then we have the surprisingly deep dive into something as seemingly trivial as smartphone colors.
Right. Sounds like manufacturers are just throwing everything at the wall to try and juice sales.
They truly are, pushing an unimaginable array of ever-changing colors and design elements, things like titanium jade green, mocha mousse hues, even an orange iPhone with 3 exclamation points. All to juice sales because the market's been in a slump for years. But do people actually care about the color that much?
Well, that's the interesting part. YouGov polls indicate most consumers prioritize battery life, a whopping 75% way over device design appearance, which only gets 23%.
So battery life trumps color by a mile.
Seems so. And while, you know, color theory suggests personal expression, the reality is protective cases are used by 85% of owners.
Which immediately hides the phone's carefully chosen color.
Exactly. Leading some critics to call this whole color obsession a marketing ploy, akin to choosing underwear hues, something personal but ultimately hidden.
A fascinating look at consumer psychology versus marketing tactics. The gap between what companies think drives sales and what consumers actually prioritize.
Leading to maybe an absurd exercise in aesthetics, yeah.
Okay, shifting back to a more serious note, there's this stark contrast emerging between perception and actual data when it comes to crime in D.C., and it has significant political implications.
Yeah, President Trump is claiming crime in D.C. is out of control. He's ordered more federal law enforcement agents into the city, and he's calling for teens as young as 14 to be charged as adults.
Okay, that's the claim. What does the data show?
The data actually contradicts this narrative pretty strongly. Local and federal data show D.C. police juvenile arrests are down almost 20% this year compared to last year.
Down 20%.
Yeah. And nationwide, juvenile arrests have been dropping consistently since the 1990s.
What about charging youth as adults? Does that work?
Experts quoted argue it actually undermines public safety. They cite a CDC study that found youths charged as adults were 34% more likely to be rearrested for violent or other crimes compared to similar youth kept in the juvenile system.
More likely to reoffend. Interesting. What about curfews?
Stricter curfews are in effect in D.C., but police report 0 violations so far in the new curfew zones.
So, despite the data showing drops in juvenile arrest and questions about the effectiveness of charging youth as adults, the perception is different.
Exactly. Specific high-profile incidents, like an attempted carjacking of a federal staffer, they understandably unnerve residents and capture presidential attention.
Right.
And this leads to the significant disconnect between the perceived crime rate and the actual data-driven crime rate. It really underscores how individual sensational incidents can shape public perception much more powerfully than broad empirical trends.
And how political rhetoric can amplify that disparity. Yeah. And then a very relatable issue for probably many listeners is highlighted in the advice column, "No one at work heeds my warnings." Deals with that frustration of having your expertise ignored.
Oh, yeah. This offers such a powerful and very relatable lens into that feeling of being undervalued at work. Touches on power dynamics, the challenge of making your voice heard effectively.
What's the specific situation?
A letter writer, experienced in a niche field, consistently has her correct predictions ignored by her male supervisors. This leads to extra work and frustration when things inevitably go wrong, as she predicted.
Ugh, been there.
Right. And despite being told, patronizingly perhaps, that she can say, "I told you so," what she really desires is to be believed proactively, to have her expertise respected up front.
So what's the advice?
The advice suggests documenting concerns, creating that paper trail, but also considering why the bosses might be ignoring her. Maybe they're disruptors themselves. Maybe they're beholden to office politics. Maybe they're simply unaware of the true costs of ignoring her advice. It suggests it's not necessarily that the Cassandra, the one who foresees disaster but isn't believed, is at fault.
Right. It might be the system or the bosses.
Exactly. It's a common, infuriating dynamic many face. Highlights that gap between merit and actual influence in many workplaces.
Okay, finally, let's delve into the world of books and culture, where stories on the page and screen offer these reflections on human nature, societal anxieties, the enduring power of art and connection.
Yeah, starting with Peter Grolnick's new biography, The Kingmaker, it focuses on Elvis Presley's manager, Colonel Tom Parker.
Ah, the Colonel. Quite a character.
Indeed. The book apparently reveals his early life as a literal carnival barker, and it details his signature snowing tactic. Yeah, burying consumers under this avalanche of ceaseless promotional gimmicks just to raise awareness for his acts. Pure hype generation.
And he wasn't actually a colonel, right? Or even named Parker originally.
Exactly. He was an undocumented Dutch immigrant who completely invented his identity and title. Despite having only a basic education, he utterly transformed the music business. First with country stars Eddie Arnold and Gene Austin, then singularly with Elvis.
And their bond was real.
The book highlights their unlikely but apparently profound bond. It's a remarkable story showing the enduring power of marketing, image, sheer will, regardless of background, to shape cultural phenomena.
And for those who enjoy a good read and maybe good company, there's some practical advice on keeping a book club going long term.
Yeah, the article, "My Book Club Has Lasted More Than 20 Years, Here's How," offers tips for longevity. Seems simple but crucial.
Like what?
Key advice includes, everyone must read the book. No faking it. The host picks the book, sets the date, leads the discussion, or delegates. And importantly, thoughtful thank you to the host are essential for goodwill.
Basic courtesy goes a long way.
It does. It emphasizes the camaraderie, the shared experience. It draws this nice analogy to the High Women song, Crowded Table, which celebrates community and connection. It reminds us of that profound human need for community, for shared intellectual pursuit, beyond just reading alone.
Critiques of culture are also present, right? There's a thought-provoking book review mentioned, What Michael Douglas Can Tell Us About the Patriarchy.
Right. Jessa Kristen's book, What Is Wrong with Men? It examines 9 Michael Douglas films.
Interesting lens. Why Michael Douglas?
To theorize about male dysphoria and misogyny in today's culture, she links it to big economic shifts, like deindustrialization, increased inequality.
Okay. And the reviews take?
The review critiques Crispin for maybe prioritizing rhetoric over well-informed argument, and for avoiding detailed current politics, instead focusing on these very broad concepts like patriarchy and capitalism.
So these cultural critiques through film or books, they help us understand societal anxieties.
About gender roles, about the nature of art in a chaotic world, yeah. Even as the critiques themselves sometimes generate their own critiques. It's part of the conversation.
Speaking of films, a true classic, Sunset Billy Z, is celebrating 75 years, and its commentary on Hollywood feels strikingly relevant even today.
It really does. Released 75 years ago, it's such a powerful, timeless commentary on Hollywood's big lie about aging stars, especially women, and the industry's deep fear of obsolescence.
Gloria Swanson's performance as Norma Desmond is iconic.
Absolutely. And it reflected her own silent era stardom and the brutal reality many actors faced when talkies arrived and suddenly they were disposable.
The film famously blurred fiction and reality too, didn't it?
Yeah, with real silent era stars playing themselves, like Buster Keaton. It reflects that constant, intense pressure on performers to remain relevant in a relentlessly evolving, often cruel industry. A classic for a reason.
And then sadly, the recent passing of the acclaimed director Robert Wilson leaves us pondering the future of the avant-garde in a world that often seems, well, beyond conventional critique.
His obituary highlights his truly monumental experimental opera, works like Einstein on the Beach, which he created with Philip Glass. Groundbreaking stuff.
How did his work challenge conventions?
He fundamentally challenged theatrical norms, paring down plot characters, setting to their absolute essences, using movement, stillness, light, language, even creating silent operas.
Silent operas.
Yeah. His avant-gardism aimed to completely reinvent operatic tradition, but on these grand stages. It demanded a kind of meditative surrender from the audience. His famous directive was, let the audience go. Don't force meaning on them.
His passing prompts a big question, doesn't it?
A profound one, raised in the obituary. In a culture steeped in meaningless doublespeak and tilting perilously toward absurdity, does a place remain in American culture for the avant-garde?
Yeah. What norms are even left to challenge?
How does one subvert a reality that does a perfectly good job of subverting itself every day? It's a poignant reflection on the state of art. Is the avant-garde's role more critical now, or maybe more challenging than ever, or even possible?
And from high art to interactive entertainment, there's also a scathing review of a new video game, Mind's Eye. Sounds like a disaster.
A disaster piece, as the review calls it. It's the debut game from a former Grand Theft Auto producer, so expectations were likely high. But it's harshly criticized as actively hostile toward the audience's desire for entertainment. Called among the worst games in history. Ouch.
Why so bad?
Slammed for fundamental design flaws, broken AI, often failing players for completely arbitrary reasons. Just fundamentally broken, it sounds like.
And the takeaway.
Cited as a cautionary tale of unchecked executive ego and imprudent short-sighted investment in just chasing trends without solid execution. A blunt reminder that a big name doesn't guarantee a big hit, and ambition without execution is worthless.
And of course, no deep dive into the Sunday paper would be complete without touching on the sports section. Gives us that snapshot of the human element of competition, team dynamics.
Absolutely. The Washington Commanders apparently had a desultory loss in their preseason opener.
Desultory.
Not good. No. Revealed clear areas for growth offense, penalties. But hey, it's still a month from week one.
Any bright spots?
Trade acquisition, Deebo Samuel apparently showed an instant click with the quarterback, which is promising. But there's concern over star receiver Terry McLaurin's ongoing contract dispute. That could impact morale, offensive consistency.
Okay. How about the Nats?
The Washington Nationals had a rare daytime win, led by pitcher Brad Lord and three solo home runs.
Improving their terrible day game record.
Slightly. They're still struggling overall with hitting an ERA in day games, but a win's a win.
And elsewhere in baseball.
A brief mention of the Oakland Athletics beating the Baltimore Orioles 11-3. Led by home runs from Shale Angeliers and Brent Rooker. Just those snapshots of the constant highs and lows, the ongoing narratives in sports.
Wow, what an incredible deep dive into today's Washington Post. We've really journeyed through the corridors of power, debated economic forces, examined the intricacies of social policy, technological impacts, even peeked into entertainment and personal journeys.
Indeed. We covered a lot of ground. And what really stands out to me, Lee, is just how interconnected all these seemingly disparate topics truly are.
It's always the connections, isn't it?
Yeah. Whether it's the impact of national tariffs on local city budgets way down the line, or the influence of social media figures on high-level political appointments.
Right.
Or the ethical dilemmas raised by new technologies like microreactors or AI, or even just the subtle ways cultural products like Sunset BLVD reflect these deep societal anxieties. It all comes back to how we as a society navigate this world.
A world just awash in information, constant, often unpredictable change.
Exactly. How do we make sense of it all?
It truly does all connect. So the question for you listening is, what will you dive deeper into after today? Perhaps it's the shifting landscape of political influence and agency independence, maybe the future of higher education under all this scrutiny, or the fascinating complex world of micronuclear reactors and their environmental implications.
So much to think about.
There's always more to explore. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst. We look forward to our next deep dive with you.